One thing that I do preach a lot is whatever seems obvious, whatever seems like the obvious way to do it, don't do it that way. Step back, look at it again, go take a shower, think about it, clear your head, sleep on it. Then the next day, you might have a better idea of how to do it.
What's up, everyone? It's Eric Vessels with Tactful. Welcome back to another episode of Tactful Tuesdays. Today on Tactful Tuesdays, we have a truly, truly special guest, someone whose creativity and expertise in digital embellishments are pushing the boundaries of print design. I have Matt Redbear, who is not only an incredible designer, but also a thought leader in the world of specialty printing. He has a deep passion for blending artistry with technology, creating stunning tactile experiences that elevate brands and captivate audiences. Whether you're a designer looking to experiment with embellishments, a brand wanting to stand out, or just a print enthusiast, you're in for a real treat today. Matt has a wealth of knowledge on how to make print more impactful, more interactive, and quite frankly, more beautiful. So let's dive in and pick his brain a bit about the future of embellishments, the magic of great design, and why details make all the difference. Matt, welcome to Tactful Tuesdays, man.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
So Matt is also officially part of the Tactful team as the creative consultant. I would almost say creative director. If we need anything designed, or if we need a creative eye, or if we need something put together, most of the things that you've seen collateral-wise, Matt has worked on for us and does an amazing job. Some of you may notice that there's yet another background behind me. It's been an evolving thing. There's been bookshelves and then empty bookshelves and now a brand new brick wall. And this view is actually even going to change because my office is not completely set up. I just moved after 32 years of being in Ohio, raising three kids. I've moved back home to Kentucky. So I'm in Kentucky, my new old Kentucky home, my parents' place. And I'm in the sunroom. But Matt, you've had some changes and some moving around going on too.
Right, but we both have brick walls.
We do. Yours is a little more mid-century modern than mine's a little more modern.
Yeah, this is 1950s mid-century, the vaulted ceilings and all that. So I have moved to North Carolina and have vacated South Florida for enormous amounts of reasons. It was time for a change and to move to a quieter area and just focus on what needs to be next.
Okay, so Florida to North Carolina, you win the distance award. I just went from Ohio to Kentucky. It's not quite as far.
Well,
so we're both in a bit of a transition.
Climate-wise, it's quite a bit different for me.
Hugely different.
Yeah.
Not quite as the distance is less, and the climate change for me is a little less, slightly warmer, but not quite as warm. Well, best of luck with the move. I definitely know what you're going through. I've got a bunch of clutter to handle. Appreciate you, man. So. Let me ask, first of all, I think a background question is tell us a little bit about kind of your background. How did you get into design? How did you get into print? And maybe most importantly, how did you dive into the world of print and embellishments and specialty printing? How that all happened for you?
Well, Eric, this is a really deep question and we could go on.
We have time. These things are known to run 20, 30 minutes, man.
But let me just touch on the highlights of it all and kind of backtrack because I've been around a long time and I started my design interest in probably the 1970s, and then it came to reality in probably 1978, 1979, working with imaging. It was all analog then, darkroom work, film work, photography, design, you know, creating design prints, creating images of design nature that needed to be photographed and represented. It goes way back. My fingerprints are gone from being dipped in trays of photographic chemistry and all that.
So were you one of those kids that were like drawing in your notebook instead of paying attention in class?
Yeah, me and my friends instead in study hall, none of us paid any attention to what was going on in class. We were making little flip books and little animations and that type of thing.
I mean, that's where the best artists are a little bit counter, I wouldn't say, well, counterculture, yeah, but just like, you know, doing their own thing and dancing to the beat of their own drum.
In their own little head.
So tell me a little bit about... kind of print. How did you get into that, and what have you what has been primary? I mean, I know for a long time you've operated an MGI machine. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you've operated and designed for. And I guess there's a little bit of a bridge between conceptually designing something and producing it. And you seem to have a real knack of how to translate those two languages.
Yeah, and lately, in recent years, it has become more difficult with the emergence of the digital technology because you almost have to know code. You have to know how all the software works, how all the networking works, how all the apps and programs work, how they integrate or don't integrate with each other, what's the next best thing. And now we have AI, and it keeps progressing forward and forward and forward and forward. And we're just like, so much is going on. Back in the days, it was simple. I migrated from photography to computer design when that was the very first thing on a DX2 chip. And you first had object linking and embedding, and you're like, wow, I can like move stuff instead of just entering coordinates and whatnot. So when that came to be a reality, then you could conceptualize things on screen and then actually get it printed out on a plotter or paper, that kind of thing, moving forward. My college back in those days was completely analog. We didn't have computers. Everything was done on film. Everything was done on plate. You stripped out all of your text and whatnot. And then when you got to the computer age in the probably the mid-90s is when it was really starting to happen. That's when it really started to get interesting for me. And it never stopped. The next best thing, whatever the new next thing. And then to be able to not only bring the images on the screen into reality through print, whether I was running the press or whether I was taking it to a service bureau to have an output for a press, that next step was always the biggest fascination for me, is getting it on a substrate, whether it was a t-shirt, a billboard, a business card, or a sheet of paper. That was the most fascinating part of it all. Now, recently, it was probably in, I can't really think of exactly what year it was going to be, but it was about 10 years into the industry of when it was conceptualized of the polymer inkjet on any substrate, basically, that creates that tactile effect, because you've got this thick varnish you're spraying on with inkjet heads, and then applying foil on top of it if you want. Digital foil and varnish became a thing, and when that got posted to a wall in my workplace as a potential thing that we would offer to our client base, I was just like, wow, just completely, right? you just put your hands all over it. It was tacked up to the wall, and just feel it and look at it and see how the light and the angles and everything plays on it. And that was just an amazing moment for me. And I thought, I gotta do this. I gotta find out a way to do it. And then when the opportunity presented itself, I jumped. I'm like, I don't care what you pay me or don't pay me. Let's go do this,
just because
I had to learn it. I had to know what it's about, because it was a complete mystery and there was no information out there about it at all. I mean, as far as the users or any technical info, you go on the computer and look, it's like there was nothing out there. And so that's furthered my interest to start creating content, to start putting it out there about what it is, how it works, what's possible. And that way people could actually, in a video sense, in a remote kind of sense, see what the potentials were.
Yeah, and if anybody watching is not following Matt on LinkedIn, you should. And if you're not going to the designer meetups that he announces quite often, you should. Because one of the things that happens there, one of the things that I notice about you almost right away, which really intrigued me, was the amount of excitement that you had for showing people a piece and explaining the piece and talking through, here's how it was conceptualized. And then we tried this, and maybe that didn't work. And then we tried this, and then we thought, well, what if we did this, right? And then you're holding it up and you're seeing it, and it just like that, you could tell that you're in love with the process of going from concept to printed output, especially when it considers a digital embellishment. And I love that. And people, please, even if you're sort of tangentially connected to this whole thing, I encourage you to go on there, because you'll get excited about the technology. You'll see stuff you haven't seen, and it'll really open your eyes. But a segue there, I want to ask, when incorporating embellishments, what are some key design principles that creatives often overlook?
The use of negative space. The one thing that I do preach a lot is whatever seems obvious, whatever seems like the obvious way to do it, don't do it that way. Step back. Look at it again. Go take a shower. Think about it. Clear your head. Sleep on it. Then the next day, you might have a better idea of how to do it. Work with the negative space. Try to find a secondary motif that can be applied to it. Or if it's a brand that has a secondary campaign, a different element, a different design, a variation on the logo that can be placed in the background, like a wallpaper, that kind of thing, then explore that possibility, because it's going to add a lot more wow to a larger surface area while using very little amounts of varnish. If you're just putting big amounts of varnish on things, that's just, no, don't, please stop. Please stop.
Yeah, there's an example, and I think one of our brochures that were done that you designed, talking about some of our consulting, one of the things that you pointed out was, what should we embellish on this woman? And it ended up just being the frames of her glasses. Mm-hmm. And that subtlety to that has always struck me about this piece. Of course, you've got the background with the raised varnish in this swirl type, I would call it like almost a geographic topographical.
It's a topographical design.
Yeah, in the background. But when you just, every now and then, the light will hit this just right and her frames just pop out. And I think that's a great example of that minimalist effect, because you might have wanted to like really put a bunch of varnish on her hair or her sweater or whatever, but really, really good thing. And what I find, because I'm a non-designer that tries to be a designer every now and then, and I struggle with negative space because I'm trying to fill all the space up. I feel like it's a requirement to like get stuff everywhere, and that's the exact wrong approach. So that's really great advice.
Yeah, the other thing that you might consider is that because it's a tactile effect, and if it's something that someone is going to take and hold, put something on the backside. Put a texture on the backside, because they will feel that when they touch it. That's where their fingers go. They're grabbing it like that. So put something on the backside for their fingers to touch, and then it'll be like, what's this? And then they'll flip it over and see what your offer or presentation is.
See, I tell you guys, you have to get on these hangouts with Mac. Like, you're always going to, something like this is going to pop, and I'm just going to be like, that's amazing. Because what you're creating is like, you're creating this multi-sensory, which is what we really talk about, right? You're seeing the front and you're feeling the back, right? And maybe you could feel with your thumbs the front, because there's a little stuff on there as well. That's really, really good advice. Good stuff.
And so it could just be dots or lines or just something very simple.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is simple the better. Play with negative space. And I also, what I hear from you a lot, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier before, is experiment. Like try a thing, you know, and try something that's different. You know, like you said, go clear your head, come up with some wacky idea, and then go try that, see what it does, and just continue. You know, from a business perspective, I've always espoused this iterative concept of like, you know, fail fast, fail small, and keep failing, because that's how you come up with the big successes, is by failing small and failing fast. Just keep trying little stuff. So
yeah, and as a reminder, the beauty of digital is that you can do something and run one sheet and say, I like it, I don't like it, or I want to change it a little bit. And then you go back and change your design a little bit. It takes just a few seconds if you're proficient. Send it back to the machine, run it through. I'm like, maybe if we did this or we did that. It's so easy to do. And you can do that with the digital process.
Well, I will tell you, one of the ways that you, in my short time being a part of the Tactful team, you've been a part of the team for much longer, going away, maybe back to the beginning.
Very beginning, yeah.
Yeah. So is that education component. And we've recently sort of rebranded sort of the training stuff to a brand called Tactical. And one of our things that we're doing, it's kind of our, I would call it our flagship thing, is our 8-week boot camp. And you've recently, we've been going through that with Hatteras, Bill Doerr, and his team.
Yes.
And part of that is you have come in and have a session that's an hour long that takes people through the entire design process. And so talk a little bit about what we're trying to educate people there from a design perspective within the framework of the 8-week boot camp.
Yeah, well, Eric, it's not just about design. It's about how to build your files properly. Because when you're sending your information as a stacked PDF, you're going to send that PDF to the RIP, to the machine, and the machine has to be able to interpret it correctly so that it separates everything out and everything's laid out and ready to go the way that you, the operator, would expect to see it. So it's about structure. It's left brain and right brain. You have to be creative. You have to have that creative element, but you also have to apply it to a specific structure that will allow the system to process the information correctly. And not only that, if you as a standalone designer, where you're freelance or you're with an agency and you're creating these files, maybe you don't have to get everything named exactly correctly, but it has to be interpreted correctly so that their setup person, their prepress person, is going to open your file and say, oh, this is what they mean. Well, I just need to change the name. This is what they want to have happen. I just need to overprint this, or I just need to multiply this. So everything, just make it to the point where people can understand what your intention is so that the output is correct. So that's a lot of what we go through, the layering conventions, the spot color naming conventions, how to structure your PDF, and a lot of the best practices that go along with the design creative side. And that's the way it is with almost every, you talk to any designer these days, and it's like that. They have to know a lot of technical info just to operate, say, the Adobe suite programs, the Creative Cloud. Just to be able to operate those systems takes a lot of left brain. And every day there's something new. Every day you learn something new. Just, it never stops.
So it sounds like you're saying, to be a really good designer, there's almost an engineering aspect to it, right?
Yeah.
You have to understand that there's another process that you're handing your work off to. And in order for that to be as efficient as it can be from a workflow perspective, or even from an output perspective, you've got to engineer it and set it up correctly.
Well,
no matter what the creative looks like, right? It's got to all be organized.
Think about it as, say, a web designer. Yeah, there's creative. Everything has to have a flow, but it has to fit within a framework. And then they have to be able to output that HTML or that HTML5 or JavaScript or whatever so that it operates correctly in the end-use browser. And then it has to be able to operate in all these different end-use browsers, all the Chrome, Firefox, Edge. It has to work correctly in all of them, as well as for mobile devices. So what they're doing is taking that creative side, that whole thing, but it has to translate into the end user. Otherwise, your creative design is worthless.
Great segue to the next question that I want to ask you, and that is, how do you approach educating clients or brands? I mean, sometimes the brand could be a client of a client, about the value of embellishments in their designs.
I usually just show them. I always have my examples. I try to take the best photographs and videos that I can and then present those. And that gets them thinking. That gets them asking the questions. Well, how did you do this? Or how did that happen? Or it encourages further questions like, well, if we did this, how about if we did that? So it's kind of a one-on-one approach. Every creative mind is different.
Yeah, for sure.
So you have to approach everybody on their level in a different way. You have to find out what their experience is, what their passion is, if they have any passion. If they don't have any passion, we need to work on that too.
Sure.
But usually it just starts with what's possible, and then that brings on the snowball of questions and interest from that point forward.
For sure. And I think one of the things I heard you say, watched one of your trainings on designing for digital embellishments live and in person, when we were in Chicago together at Paperspecs Live. And one of the things that you said is don't always, like, less is more. Don't assume that you have to embellish. Like, don't embellish for the sake of embellishment. And I think that's such a wise piece of advice, to be discerning about where you're applying specific tools to specific design areas and print outputs, right? Just like, I feel the same way about when QR codes came out, or like, when we first had like digital printing where you could have variable data. It was just like, we were just using variable data just because we could, and it wasn't necessarily the right application. Or when you put a QR code on a road sign, it's just like, make sure the application is appropriate for what it is. And digital embellishment's no different.
And there are times where you might actually want to do some overkill, where I'm moving into the world of packaging. It needs to be flashier, it needs to be louder, it has to scream from the shelf. So yeah, you really gotta like lay it on thick. So you're always kind of balancing that out, like how much is too much or how much is too little. But in general, when people show me examples that they've really laid on a lot of varnish and foil, it's visually overstimulating. I tend to be visually overstimulated, and it actually makes me want to look away. So you also have to be aware of which audience you're pandering to. Is it packaging? Is it a wedding invitation? You don't want to do heavy coverage on a wedding invitation. It needs to be subtle and elegant. Whereas if it's on a shelf, it needs to scream at the people who are walking by.
Well, and it also matters like what stage of life is that product in, right? If it's trying to gain shelf space, you want it to yell louder, right? But as it starts to gain momentum, you could dial it back a little bit, and we talk about that a lot in
Absolutely.
some of our stuff.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it tangentially, and I want to maybe take a deeper look at it, is the role that you think AI and automation will play in the future of embellishment design. So what's coming, or what's already happening in AI? I mean, we see AI is unavoidable now in terms of content generation, and even in terms of creative generative AI. Where do you see that going, and how do you see that working within the context of print design and embellishment?
Well, as you mentioned, it's already happening and it's already in process. So a lot of things you and I can't even talk about because it's just in the works, and when it happens, then we're going to be like, ah, look at this. But it's going to be a nonstop process, and nobody really knows where it's going to end up or what direction it's going to take, except that it's going to continue to move forward. That's a given. It's
At
not
a pace.
Yeah, it's and it's going to pick up the pace as we move forward because the AI will generate more AI. And I have firsthand seen that happen, and I'm just like seriously blown away. And everything that I've already seen, everything that I've already done, and I was an early adopter of AI as far as generative imaging or script writing, or I use it all the time for everything. It's not replacing me, it's adding to what I can do. It's adding to the point. And you apply for any job anymore, and they want to know what AI based skills
Are you
you
good at
have.
prompting? Yeah, are you good at prompter?
Yeah, they want to know what AI tools you're using to enhance your job. It's now a part of your resume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got two final questions, and we're gonna have some fun
Okay.
with these. I like to have fun.
Okay.
It's a rule of mine. I don't know if I've mentioned it publicly, but I know I have privately. When I stop having fun, I quit. Like, that's just a personal rule. So we're gonna have fun. If I gave you a design job for an embellishment heavy project and you have no budget constraints whatsoever, what would you create?
Okay, so that has actually happened a few times. And so what that does is it does it 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 of you have no limits as far as many times you can send
Does that make
something.
it harder or easier?
Well, it makes it more difficult because now you're pushing the limit as far as what the front ends can handle for file
So
separation
this
or
is
an
just
e
you personally, though.
yeah.
Okay, I'm giving you a ton of money. I'm gonna say, hey, Matt, you can create a digital embellished product. It can be whatever. What would that be? What would you want to create?
Well, it would probably involve a couple different technologies, such as a fifth and sixth color station on a toner-based printer, and it would involve the foil, polymer foil and varnish overlays, such as on the MGI. So it would be a combination of two things. It could even involve some flatbed printing that can combine all of it together,
Larger pieces.
because you have 7 to 10 ink colors, which could include white and varnish and an underlay that creates a texture. It's really limitless, Eric. I mean, one thing that I really want to do is like start reproducing artwork as it was done, whether it was a stippling or as it was a palette knife with an oil paint or something like that. This can be done with this technology, and it does exist now as.
There's I'm wanting to say Swiss Cube Print
Yes.
has shown they're showing a lot of that type of technology with art prints to be able to use that kind of palette knife type look. I can't remember the name of the device now, but I know they've got something out that does that. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's just going to be bonkers what we eventually do. I mean, we always look back and wonder, how did we get here, right? So last question that's kind of fun, all right? When you're not completely geeking out over print designs and digital embellishment, what do you do for fun? What do you do? I mean, obviously, everybody who looks at you, like, you obviously do some type of resistance training with heavy stuff because you're a big guy.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Presently not, because, you know, of all the moving and everything, but I'll get back into it.
But that's lifting heavy weights.
That's lifting heavy weights, yeah. I don't know. I do need to find some new hobbies, that's for sure. I'm definitely into music, a lot of the analog versions of music. And
You a big vinyl head?
I actually just bought another turntable 2 days ago. I was in an antique mall, and you don't really expect to see things like that in an antique mall, but there was a Garrard Lab 80, and it's the one with the wood tone arm. It's one of the earliest versions of what was considered a changer, you could stack the records, that was also a better high fidelity version of a turntable in 1964. That makes it That makes me 1 year older than that turntable that I just carried home the other day. Yeah. And it's really heavy, and it needs to be restored, and I absolutely love it. So I'm going to probably keep moving in that direction
You'll do the restoration?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Have you done that before?
Yeah, I just did a Technics SLD-2. Which was a 1979 unit. It was it was Japanese. It was made in Japan. So the turntables that were made in Japan were the best in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
They had versions, similar versions that were made in the U.S. of the same model number. But if you're a collector or someone who wants to restore it, you always buy the Japanese version.
So what's interesting is I just discovered, because they're laying right here, I just discovered a collection of my stepfather who's passed tons of 45s. He's got a big case of them, so I've been playing them. There's an Audio Technica behind me with a Marshall speaker. So this, I'm glad that I discovered and dug a little bit about this. Your favorite vinyl album. What is the favorite album you have to play? Top one. There can only be one. You have to pick.
Oh.
I know. You want me to share mine? Will that give you time?
Well, I kind of know, but everyone's going to think, really?
Well, just really? Say it.
It would have to be Art of Noise, in a sense. It would have to be Art of Noise. There's something, it was such a commercial pressing, but when you put that album on, the whole soundstage opens up.
A soundscape. Yeah.
It is, I have a 7-channel system, and so it reinterprets it into 7 channels. It's a stereo disc, but everything is moving around the room, like behind you and above you and below you.
Before I come to North Carolina to visit, you have to have it set up to play that.
Yeah.
I want to lounge with that. I'll bring the bourbon. We'll have a nice, big, heavy glass of bourbon. So mine, not that it matters. Art of Noise is a really good choice. Miles Davis Kind of Blue, because I have an original album that my stepfather bought in Germany the year that it came out.
Nice.
And I have that sitting right over here. I play it almost every night.
Yeah, most of the jazz I have is like Lightnin' Hopkins and Billie Holiday, that type of stuff.
Any Brubeck? Got some Brubeck?
Only on most of the Blue Note stuff or Blue Note style stuff, I do have on CD.
Gotcha.
Because it was remastered nicely.
I'm glad we dug that out. We've not talked vinyl or music since I've known you, and now we got that out of you. Now we're going to geek out forever about it.
Yeah, definitely.
I love it. Well, Matt, this has been amazing. Thank you for being a guest. Thank you for being a colleague and a teammate at Tactful also. Love working with you, and I love your ability to translate a lot of knowledge into teachable moments for people, and I really appreciate what you do there. Best of luck in your move and the new gig and all that stuff, and look forward to keep working with you, man.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks, brother.
I mean, nothing is more important to a brand than color consistency. So if your toner device is not printing great color that day and your 185 red is not 185, you've got a problem. And sometimes you can't wait for a tech to come out. So then you're learning to use spectrophotometers. You're learning to measure on the fly. You're learning to do different wizards to make sure your equipment is within calibration. So it's not super easy,